All right, we're going to get started here in a minute. If you have a seat next to you that's open, do you maybe want to raise your hand so some of these people in the back can come forward? Okay, don't be shy. There are like 10 seats. Okay. Great. Everyone is excited about soil today. All right, I think we have a lot to cover, so we're going to be prompt and get started. So thanks, everybody, for being here. My name's Natalie. I work with Extension in Minnesota as a vegetable crops educator.
I'm Lauren Berry from Dancing Gnome Farm in Wabasha, Minnesota.
And I'm Skylar Hawkins from Urban Roots in East St. Paul.
And you can see Paolo's name's on here, too. He's not here, but he helped with this. So basically, you're going to hear from me for like 40 minutes or so. And we're going to talk about data and soils and all the things we learned in this project. And then the fun part, you're going to get to hear from Lauren and Skylar from two different farmers' perspectives about how they're thinking about all these things that we learned and how they're implementing it on their two very, very different farms. So just to get a sense of who's in here, how many of you are vegetable farmers? Okay. And how many of you have a high tunnel? Or maybe how many of you don't have a high tunnel, but you're thinking about it? You maybe want a high tunnel? Great. All right. So we're going to be talking about a project today that we have done over the last year with 100 farms in Minnesota, and I know you're not all from Minnesota, but I think you'll find that many of the practices that we were looking at are kind of universal across farms. And the main reason we did this is because, as you probably know, there's really been an increase in vegetable production. So at a time when we've been losing farmers for decades, we've actually been gaining small-scale vegetable growers. There are fewer barriers to entry, so a lot of people who don't come from a farming background are starting to grow vegetables. And that's super exciting. It also means that a lot of people who are farming are kind of starting from scratch. They don't have like that family mentorship. We also, I think, have done a pretty bad job of making nutrient management and soil recommendations for diversified farms. Most of the recommendations that we have are like, you need to apply 100 pounds of nitrogen per acre to your sweet corn. It's like, what does that mean when you have 30 different crops and you're using compost and manure? And so I've been in this role for about 5 years and have seen a lot of soil tests and have seen a lot of soil and had some suspicions, but wanted to get a better baseline. So decided to do this project. Let's look at 100 farms and just see what's happening in the soil. And at the same time, high tunnels have become increasingly popular. They are common around the world, but we haven't really used them in the Midwest until about 10 years ago, maybe 15 years ago. And we're getting like hundreds of high tunnels every year. And something that farmers were telling me was that things look great for the first 3 years. And then things start to not look so good. And people start to have some problems. And we had some suspicions, but wanted to better understand what's happening in the soils of high tunnels. So that is, all of you who are thinking about building a high tunnel, do so. You don't fall into the same problems. So that was the motivation. Let's just better understand what's going on in soils on diversified farms, figure out what's going on in high tunnels, and we'll add in some more fun, like, soil health testing, too. We're not just going to do nutrient management. Let's look at a bunch of soil health metrics. So we designed this project where we went to 100 farms last April and May. Urban Roots and Dancing Gnome were two of those farms, so I'm really happy they can be here today. We had a team of local educators who did a lot of the soil testing, a team of specialists and labs that did different soil health tests. It's not, maybe not the best representation of Minnesota, but this is a good representation of where the vegetable farms are in the state. It's also where we have capacity and educators. So we looked at a high tunnel and a field at each of these farms so we could compare what was different. So I'm going to start with some farm demographics, just so you can get a sense of, like, how does my farm compare? How similar am I to these 100 farms? So the average farm was about 5 acres, had been in production for 7 years. Most people were not certified organic, but were using organic practices. So kind of falling into this spectrum of, yeah, not certified, but really relying on compost, manure, using very few pesticides. The average field had about almost 4% organic matter. That's a little higher than the average farm field in Minnesota, but not that much higher. The average tunnel had 5.4% organic matter. That's more like the average garden in Minnesota. So just to give you a sense of how similar your farm might be. And I'm going to talk at the beginning here about inputs, because this really informs a lot of what we were seeing. So most of the people in this study used composted manure as a primary input on their farm. So everything in green is once or more than once per year. Yellow is every few years. Red is never. Lots of people using things like blood meal, feather meal, these organic supplements. And then vegetable compost. Some fresh manure, but not a lot. And then very few people using synthetic fertilizers or synthetic nitrogen like urea. And something that was really interesting to me was that most of the people who participated in this were doing soil tests on a regular basis and were using soil tests to inform nutrient decisions. But when it came to composted manure, which was the most frequently used input, and I apologize, this might be small for those of you in the back, but not that many people were applying composted manure based on soil tests. People were applying a set amount, so like an inch a year kind of approach, or just as much as they could get. And so people were not really thinking about composted manure as a nutrient source, even though they were doing soil testing and thinking about nutrient management in other ways. So that's a little background. And we're going to jump into this first question. I know not all of you have high tunnels, but we're going to start with high tunnels, and then we'll broaden the scope and talk about fields. So how many of you have, like, experienced this, where your high tunnel just isn't looking as great after a few years? Are there any thoughts about what might be happening? Too many broadleaves? Too much salt, I think I heard. It's dusty. Yeah. Hydrophobic, yeah. Nice. All right, so we had a few ideas. And if you look at, like, literature about high tunnels, there are two big assumptions that come up. One is this idea that we push high tunnels really hard. We're growing more out of them for a longer period of time, and so it must be really hard on the soil. So there's kind of this idea that high tunnel soils are depleted. And then the other big idea is that salts build up in the soil. So we wanted to look at those as well as a couple other things. And so this first hypothesis that high tunnel soils are being depleted really didn't turn out to be true in any way. In fact, we saw the opposite. So organic matter was higher in tunnels. Soil nitrates were really high in tunnels. Phosphorus was really high. Potassium was pretty high. Magnesium, calcium, everything was higher in tunnels. And I put those red lines on the graphs at the point that we would consider to be, like, very high for all of these things. So for the most part, high tunnels were not depleted. there's more than sufficient of all of these things in tunnels. Our second thing we looked at was salt accumulation. And if any of you have seen me talk about this, this is kind of a new take. So we did one method and found that none of the tunnels were salty, but then we reanalyzed some of them using a better method, and 16%, so 16 of the 100 tunnels were moderately saline. 5% were very slightly saline, but the majority of them were still not showing up as saline. And when we looked at what was driving that, the first thing we thought about was the age. Are they becoming saltier with time? And so on all these, the electrical conductivities, the soluble salts, and then whatever variable on the bottom. So we didn't really see that. It wasn't that they were accumulating salts over time. I think this is soil pH, so we thought maybe the soil pH is connected. Not really. There's a little bit of a trend, but it's not very strong. So then we looked at the water. Maybe the water is depositing salts. Is it the pH of the water? Is it the alkalinity? We didn't really see that. If anything, there was a negative trend with alkalinity. So then we thought, how about inputs? And the main thing we saw was that nitrates in the soil were the thing that was the most strongly correlated with salt. And so if you remember a couple slides ago, we have a lot of inputs in our tunnels. We have a lot of nutrients in our tunnels. The tunnels that had the most nitrates also tended to be the saltiest. But again, this didn't explain everything. Only 16% of the tunnels had salt buildup. So the next thing we looked at was the pH of the soil in tunnels. So pH is really important because if your soil pH is in that window of about 5.8 to 7, that's a window where plants can efficiently use nutrients. And so even if you have a lot of nutrients in your soil, if the pH is not right, your plants can't effectively access those nutrients. And what we saw was that in high tunnels, we had a higher pH. I know these graphs are not the most user-friendly. I have a couple of them in here because I really like them and I think they're useful. So basically, when you look at this graph, you see a box with a line through it. That line through the middle is the average. And then 25% of the tunnels are at the top of that box, 25% are at the bottom, and then 25% are underneath it, and 25% are above. So that kind of gives you a sense of not just the average, but how are people kind of spread out. So in general, the tunnels tended to be at a pH that was a little higher than we wanted to be. And in this case, we did find that in fields, there was no influence of time, but in high tunnels, the pH is going up over time. In terms of why that was, we think that it has a lot to do with water. But every single person's water was not ideal. So the average pH of irrigation water is about 6.3. Every single person's pH was too high, and every single person's alkalinity was too high. And that means that you're potentially depositing soluble salts and influencing the pH of your soil through your water. The average water had a pH of 7.9. That's a lot higher than 6.3, and then a lot of alkalinity. I don't know what this would look like in other states, but if you live in a place with hard water, this is definitely something that could influence it. And then the other thing, this was not as correlated with inputs in the way that soluble salts were, but definitely heavy input use could influence the pH of your soil in a high tunnel. And then the fourth thing we looked at was water dynamics. So I think you said the soil's dusty, right? So we noticed when we went to these 100 farms in April and May, the majority of the tunnels were totally empty. They were not being used at that time of year. People were still getting ready to plant. And so they hadn't been watered all winter. And when we did these infiltration tests, in 26% of the tunnels, 1 inch of water was absorbed in less than 30 seconds. And then in 21% of them, we added a second inch of water, and that water was gone in 30 seconds. And so this is harder to quantify, but there was just this really clear dynamic that the soil was really dried out. And what happens, I think you said this, is that have you ever, gotten a bag of potting soil that's really dry and is really hard to get it wet again? It kind of repels the water. That's the dynamic that we were seeing in some of these tunnels at the surface of the soil. Which is going to have implications for irrigating your tunnel, right? So that's harder to quantify, but we saw this dynamic quite a bit, especially in systems where people had used a lot of compost, that the soil was just really dried out at the surface. So basically, we were kind of able to reject this idea that nutrient depletion is happening and that instead we may have too many nutrients. And at least in the case of nitrate, that might be causing salt problems in tunnels. But even more so, the pH in tunnels was really probably causing some problems. And then just these weird water dynamics. Do you have a question? Nope. So if we go back, the question was like, what is the natural pH of the soil? So you can see here on the left, we've got fields, and then on the right, we've got tunnels. And so it was substantially higher in tunnels than in the field. In Wisconsin, you have a lot more really acidic soils. And so if you're starting with really acidic soil, it may not be a bad thing that your tunnel's becoming a little bit more basic. But if you're starting with a neutral soil and then you're being pushed out of that range, it's not great. So actually, there were a couple farmers in this study who had really acidic soils kind of up around the bog areas of northern Minnesota, and their tunnels were in the perfect range. Whoops. Okay. So in terms of what we can do about this, and we're going to come back more to solutions at the end, but I didn't want to leave you hanging for the rest of this. Some of the folks who participate in this have started to experiment with acidifying irrigation water. This is a really common practice in the greenhouse industry. It's just not really something we've done in high tunnels. But using sulfuric acid or nitric acid or in an organic system, citric acid to bring the pH of your water down is something that is probably worth doing for at least some people. Reducing inputs, like really being aware of nitrates so that you're not causing salt problems, and just kind of from an environmental perspective so that you're not leaching nitrates into the water. Removing plastic for periods of time. I know people always say that, and it's really annoying because removing the plastic from your high tunnel is an annoying thing to do. But in the years where you're having to replace your plastic, just like leaving it for a couple months if you can make a big difference. The alkalinity of rainwater is a lot lower, so it can help flush out some of those salts. And then cover crops. Like, these really basic soil health principles of keeping the soil covered can do a lot for your soil getting really dried out in the winter. So I think that's something we should be thinking a little bit more about, is just how do we keep these systems from basically becoming deserts with little strips of drip irrigation. Any quick questions about high tunnels? And we're going to move on and talk more broadly about fields. Okay.
Yeah, but the 100, did anybody collect rainwater?
So the question was anyone collecting rainwater? I don't know for sure, but collecting rainwater from the roof of a high tunnel is definitely a food safety concern. So unfortunately not something that I can promote. And then we'll take one more.
I'm wondering if you can distinguish between someone doing just summer crops versus either winter growing or growing more year round.
We didn't get into like specific crops that people were growing as much, just because a lot of it was just so much. These were really diversified farms. So we didn't. Okay, one more question, then we'll keep going.
As a follow-up to that, so if you're saying in that period of late spring, you were seeing basically no production, is that pretty much across the board? So that would be maybe only two croppings versus continuous three croppings?
I would say in maybe 20% of the farms that I visited, people had things actively growing in the spring, but the majority were just kind of empty at that point. Okay, so now we're going to zoom out a little bit, talk beyond high tunnels. What are we seeing in vegetable fields? And this study really started from a perspective of wanting to understand phosphorus. That's partially because I come from a water quality background and have been very driven to figure out, like, how do we grow food in a way that doesn't pollute our water? And phosphorus is the main limiting nutrient in freshwater ecosystems. So when we see lakes flip and become algal dominated, that happens when there's excess phosphorus. And also because, if you remember at the beginning, most people are using composted manure as a primary input. And composted manure tends to have a lot of phosphorus and a lot of potassium and not enough nitrogen. And so if you're not careful, or if you're using composted manure as your primary fertility source, it's really easy to overdo it in attempting to get enough nitrogen to your crops. And then I was just seeing really high levels of phosphorus on people's soil tests. So I wanted to know, like, am I just like thinking of these few farms, or is this a more widespread thing? And so what we found was that 87% of tunnels and 84% of fields had very high levels of phosphorus at a point where we would not recommend any additional phosphorus. And for the most part, we were doing these visits before people had applied their fertility for the spring. So this was like left over from last year. I'm gonna show one of these graphs again, just so you can see the distribution. So we measure phosphorus in two different ways in Minnesota. If your soil pH is below 7.4, or if it's 7.4 or less, we do a test called Bray. And if it's higher, we do a test called Olson. So you're basically looking at the same thing, just two different ways to measure phosphorus. And that red line is the point that we consider to be very high. And so the median in every system here is well above that. And in high tunnels, it's like really well above that. And you can see in some of the high tunnels, it's like 10 times the point that we already consider to be very high. So we were able to say, yes, we maybe do have a collective phosphorus problem here. Does it matter? I think that's an important question. Vegetable farms have a small footprint on the landscape. Y'all tend to use a lot of conservation practices. But what we know, at least from studies in field crops, is that your soil test phosphorus, so on all of from all these different studies, this one from Minnesota and Wisconsin, one from Iowa, one from Ontario, your soil test phosphorus level, so that's on the x-axis on the bottom, is a really good predictor of the amount of phosphorus that's leaving your farm in the form of either surface runoff or leachate that's moving down through the soil. So we consistently see that trend across farms in the Midwest. And so we had approached this thinking, like, people are using a lot of composted manure, so we probably have this problem where we don't have enough nitrates or nitrogen. We have too much phosphorus and potassium. But nitrates were also higher than we expected. And I'm not showing a graph because we looked at nitrates in kind of a non-standard way. We just looked at the top 6 inches of soil, where typically you'd look at 24. But Paolo, who's a nutrient management specialist at the U, helped us kind of come up with a guesstimate that if you had around 40 parts per million of nitrate in those top 6 inches and about 4% organic matter, you could probably make it through the whole season without any additional nitrogen fertilizer. So about a third to a half of the farms had enough nitrogen early in the spring that they could have probably gotten through a year. That still means we have this phosphorus question. The amount of phosphorus we were seeing in farms was maybe enough to get you through like 10 years. So it's still a question of how do we provide enough nitrogen without all the phosphorus. But we may also be overdoing nitrogen in some cases as well. So what do we do? And actually, I put a note on here too that at least I totally understand that soil tests are complicated and they don't translate well to diversified systems. But at the very least, being able to use a soil test to make sure that you're not like significantly crossing a threshold is maybe one way to use them as a tool, even if you're not doing like all of the math involved in nutrient management calculations. So I wanted to, well, actually, let's pause for a sec. Do we have any questions yet? Yeah.
Okay, when I soil test, my phosphorus is always high.
Yep.
But it doesn't seem like it's available to the plant.
Why do you say that? Why is it not available?
I don't
So typically, like a phosphorus deficiency in a plant would look like purple leaves. And often we see that in the spring, even if it's not deficient, because phosphorus is slow when it's cold. But if you have a different deficiency, that's still going to limit how much your plant can grow. So I would guess that if you're not seeing the growth you want, it's probably not because of a lack of phosphorus. It's a lack of something else. And it maybe looks like phosphorus. They're like magnesium or potassium. They don't exactly turn the plant purple, but they create some chlorosis that can look a little purple sometimes. So I'd say, like, reach out to your extension person or someone else to get some help figuring out what's missing. Okay. Yeah.
Were you able to see any difference between farms that used manure-based compost versus a, root vegetable-based compost or other kinds of compost?
Yeah. So there, the question is, were we able to see differences between farms that use different types of inputs? We still have some digging through the data to do, but I think so many people used compost and manure as like a primary input that, yeah, it was kind of hard to tease out the differences. Okay, so we're gonna do a little case study, and there's gonna be a lot of math on the screen that you can basically ignore. Just kind of pay attention to the concept, but I wanted to put it there in case anyone wants to understand how we got here. So the average farm in this study had 4% organic matter, 65 parts per million phosphorus, and 170 parts per million potassium. So I used the Minnesota Nutrient Management Guide to figure out what needed to be added to the average field to grow tomatoes, broccoli, or watermelon this year. So all of the farms needed nitrogen. They needed between 80 and 160 pounds. They didn't need any phosphorus. And they needed about 50 pounds of potassium to grow these three crops. So I wanted to look at two different ways that I see people applying nutrients. So the first is through a deep compost mulch system. So basically, let's have a scenario where we apply 1 inch of compost to every bed. And we can do that with two different types of compost. So compost A is yard waste. So just like your basic yard waste compost from your yard waste site. Compost B was composted dairy manure. I have lots of numbers here that show you how I made these guesses. But we're kind of guesstimating about 1,000 pounds per cubic yard, adding an inch, and then we have some rough estimates of nutrient contributions. And so if we were to apply 1 inch of yard waste, we have just applied 326 pounds of nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium. And our needs were more like 100 pounds of nitrogen, 0 pounds of phosphorus, and 50 pounds of potassium. And the big, big caveat is that all that nitrogen is tied up in organic matter. So you're not going to get all that nitrogen, but you will get the phosphorus and potassium. So even yard waste, which we think of as like nothing, right? It's just organic matter, is adding a lot more than we need. And if we do that same thing with composted dairy manure, we have added almost 2,000 pounds of P and K. And so that's just an inch of compost. It's not that much. I wanted to run that again with like a more conservative scenario. So I also see people take this approach where they add like 1 5-gallon bucket to a 100-foot row. So I'm imagining a three-foot bed, 5 feet on center. So if we did that, that's equivalent to about 66 cubic feet per bed. 2 cubic yards per acre. This adds a lot less. Here we're only adding about 5 pounds of N, P, and K, so that's pretty reasonable. You're still adding organic matter to that bed. If we did it with dairy cow manure, we'd be adding more like 30 pounds of P and K, 20 pounds of nitrogen. So definitely a more conservative approach, but even with just the 5-gallon bucket of dairy manure, we're still adding a lot more phosphorus than we need. And with both of these, we're not actually meeting our nitrogen needs at all. And so like a much more tailored approach is needed to get to where our crops need to be without all the extra stuff. I'll come to your question in a sec. Well, do you have a clarifying question?
Yeah, was that a 5-gallon bucket for how much space?
So a 5-gallon bucket per 100-foot row. Yeah. So what do we do? What does it look like to apply nitrogen without all the extra stuff? Any ideas? Just shout it out. Urea is an option. Ammonia, we've got some really concentrated synthetic forms of nitrogen. Those are tools that we have access to. What other tools do we have access to? Yeah, cover crops. Anything else? Yeah. Has anyone ever spread like 1,000 pounds of blood meal in a field? How did that go? People do it. I know people who do it, and they're happy with it. It's sticky. It's weird. It smells bad, but it works. So, yeah, you all kind of got to this. So conventional growers have things like urea, ammonium. We can be adding really large quantities of blood meal or feather meal. People do it. It works. I think if you haven't gotten to this point yet, and there are plenty of people who have not yet gotten to the point where phosphorus is like off the charts, just kind of taking a more balanced approach. So using more of the yard waste compost versus compost and manure, using like the 8-2-4 instead of the 4-6-4. In the long term, that's like an important strategy. And I think more and more, as I've dug through all of this, my conclusion has been that cover crops really have to be a part of our nitrogen solutions so that we're not all applying like 2,000 pounds of blood meal every year to our fields. In terms of all the extra phosphorus, so we still have this situation where there's a lot of extra phosphorus on the landscape. So not adding more is one part of this, a really important part of this. But also thinking about mitigating what's there and making sure that it's not running off and making sure that it's leaching. So again, that brings us back to basic soil health principles, like using cover crops. There are really great programs with NRCS and soil water conservation districts that I think are really underutilized with vegetable growers. We all are using EQIP for high tunnels, but how can we use these programs to put in more perennials and buffers and berms and things to stop erosion from happening? To mitigate phosphorus runoff. So I have a few more slides about soil health, but any questions about nutrient management in fields?
I have heard that you shouldn't use animal-based fertilizers in tunnels, but I see, like, blood meal and urea meal are
animal-based. Is that true? Yeah, so I think the question was about using animal-based fertilizers in high tunnels. I think some of that comes from the fact that manure tends to be high in salts. There are also some food safety concerns, but products like blood meal and feather meal, I think, should be check with your food safety person in your state. But I think those are the two main concerns. It's just making sure you're not applying like fresh manure that's going to cause food safety problems and avoiding salt buildup. So I have a few more slides left I wanted to share about soil health, because that's more exciting than nutrient management sometimes. So we did a bunch of soil health tests as part of this project. And unfortunately, I think a lot of the tests that we did are maybe not worth it for you to do. But that's good to know, too. So we looked at things like cation exchange capacity, which I know is really popular on soil health tests. It was really well correlated to organic matter and the clay content of your soil, which makes sense because that's where cation exchange capacity comes from. We did a test, Julie's here, Julie's lab did active carbon with POX-C, permanganate oxidizable carbon. We were really excited about that. We thought we might see some cool differences. So active carbon is looking at like the microbe candy, essentially. What is it really easy for microbes to eat? And we thought we might see some big differences between farms that use a lot of compost versus farms that use more cover crops. And it was also kind of just correlated with organic matter. We did counts of arbuscular mycorrhizal spores, and it was really inconclusive. So these are all things that were exciting to test, but maybe not worth it for you to do at this point. The one thing we really did see was that tillage had a really significant impact. So we gave every farm a tillage score. We asked them how often they did deep tillage, shallow tillage, and then manual tillage like broad forks. And basically more tillage meant smaller aggregates. So we were able to look at soil aggregates. Does anyone know what a soil aggregate is? It's like a clump of soil held together by roots and root hairs and all of the exudates from microbes. And they're really important for your soil structure and your soil's ability to withstand disturbance. And so we were able to have a disturbance event where we put like a really hard stream of water on them, and then we shook the aggregates out into different size classes. And where we saw more tillage, there were smaller aggregates. We also saw more compaction in the fields that were tilled more, and that the water infiltrated a lot more slowly into fields with more tillage. We actually didn't see as much with cover crops, but I think if you remember, the average farm was like 7 years old. It might take some more time to see some of those benefits. And we may not have been measuring all the ways that we could have seen benefits. But tillage really stood out. So what do we do with all this information? Got a couple takeaways, and then you get to hear what two farmers are actually doing with this information. One is, I just want to encourage people to get help with your nutrient management plan. It is overwhelming, and it's a lot of math, but Extension people can help you work through a plan for your farm. So I encourage you to take advantage of that. Consider more cover crops, both from the perspective of adding nitrogen to your farm, and in high tunnels from the perspective of just like preventing that drying out from happening. We have a lot of tools on our Minnesota Extension YouTube page and our website. I also like to tell people to look at the SARE guide to cover crops. It's really, really good. If anyone's interested, we are going to be doing a collaborative trial this next growing season, so starting next fall, where we will send you a bunch of free cover crop seed to try in your high tunnel. So I've got some flyers if anyone's interested in that. Reducing tillage. There's a really great group. Are any of you part of this? The Climate Resilient Organic Vegetable Production Group? No. Okay. It's a group of farmers in Minnesota and Wisconsin who are all trying to reduce tillage in vegetable systems. And they just like get together once a month and talk about it, learn from each other. So definitely check out that group. We've got a few tools on our webpage. And I think there's still a lot we need to do to figure out how to make acidifying irrigation water practical. Especially if you're organic and using citric acid. We know that it works. We don't have a lot of guidance about, like, do you actually need to do it every time? Could you do it once a week? Could you do it once a month? But this is something that's worth, I think, experimenting with and looking into more. And then just think about ways, if you do have excess phosphorus on your landscape, to mitigate that. So those basic soil health principles, putting in perennials, thinking about runoff. So with that, I think we have maybe two more minutes for questions. And then, Lauren, you're going to go first, right? No, Skylar's going to go first. Any questions? you look very enthusiastic back there. Yeah, so there are differences between different manures. If I just try to remember off the top of my head, I might say it wrong. We have a really good guide on our Extension website about maintaining fertility in an organic system that has a table of all the different types of animal manures and their NPK ratios. I would also say, though, that manure is highly variable, and it's worth getting it tested so that you actually know what you're adding. And I forgot the second part of your question.
What is a good recommendation for, like, an 842 input?
Oh, so any, I cannot like stand up here and endorse any specific company, but most of the major producers of fertility products, so like Sustain, Ohio Earth Food, Vermont Comp, like all of those companies will have different ratios, and most of them have one that's higher in nitrogen. How about the person next to you who's standing up? That was, oh, you were also raising your hand. Okay. Any other questions? Yeah. So it's Minnesota and North, like kind of upper Midwest and Northeast. But we could probably fit in a few other people too. There's someone along the wall. Yeah. Yep. Yeah, it's a little lower in nitrogen, but alfalfa meal, cottonseed meal, there are a couple, like soybean meal, a number of different, like legume plant-based ground plant products that can be used. There are fish products that are higher in nitrogen and lower in phosphorus. I mean, I think they could be. There are options in your toolbox to think about. It, like, think about price differences, think about what's feasible, but yeah. Okay, I'm gonna do like two more questions and then I wanna make sure they have time. So Emily, do you?
Yeah, I just wanted to ask if you know or if, of any research or if this at all covered the difference between the pH of like groundwater catchment or surface, you know, obviously surface plant
yeah.
like that versus well water.
That's a great question. I wish we would have asked if people were using surface versus groundwater. We didn't. Except, I mean, we know that every single one of these 100 farms had a pH that was way higher than we wanted it to be and an alkalinity that was higher than we wanted it to be. And certainly some of them were using surface water.
So it may not matter, really. The pH might be similar.
It might not. Yeah. I mean, if, like, test your water and see where it's at.
Sounds like that's what I'm
headed, yeah. Yeah.
Thanks.
And then, did you have... We thought we were looking at them, and then we weren't, but we're currently doing, we thought that that was part of the analysis package, and then we got all the data back, and it wasn't there, so that is, like, actively being done right now, and I'm sure we'll see some differences. Yeah, not yet, but they're on the way. Okay, I'm going to hand it over to Skylar, and also this session ends, and then there's, like, a lot of time. So we can hang out and keep talking after this.
Thank you. Oops, sorry, Natalie. Okay, hey everybody. My name's Skylar again. I farm at Urban Roots. Raise your hand if you're from Urban Roots in here. There's so many. Cool. So you can ask them questions too. I'll have less graphs. I'm sorry. So you'll have to remember all of the graphs that Natalie showed. But I'm just excited to talk to you all about how we're thinking about our soil health on our farm. So that's on the farm in East St. Paul. I do want to just say I've got about 15 minutes and there's a lot to cover. But, you know, our farm is very unique, so I want to give some context about what we do. Here we are, you know, we're a nonprofit farm. So we were formed in 1969. But, you know, what we're doing with growing food started in the 1990s. And Urban Roots isn't just farming. There's three programs. There's the Market Garden program, which you'll hear a lot about. There's the conservation program that we run as well. And there's a Cook Fresh program, too. We're a youth development program. We do a lot of other awesome things, but that's why we're coming to work every day, and that's what our work's about. So the farm is just one of the spaces where we're doing that work. We have 90 high school-aged youth who work with us each summer as paid interns. Youth make a lot of our decisions, and we're on the east side of St. Paul. So yeah, like I said, we are a youth development program, but we are also a production farm. So we have 5 separate parcels of land that make up 1.5 acres of actual production space. I think we have more like a 4-acre farm footprint, but 1.5 is what we're actually growing food on. That doesn't include our two community gardens. The 4 acres does include our orchard space, and we grow around 90 varieties of fruits and vegetables. We have two community gardens. There's 40 families on the east side who garden there. It was fun bumping into one of them earlier today. I didn't know they were going to be here. And some of the ways we get food to community members are farmers markets. We do wholesale to restaurants and grocery stores. We have a lot of community meals through our Cook Fresh program. A lot of plugging into community giveaway events on the east side in the community. And then home with our youth, too. Yeah, I just wanted to put some pictures in here. You know, you've been inside. There aren't any windows in here. So I wanted you to be able to look at a farm. These are both at one of our growing spaces called Rivoli Bluff. It's our largest growing space. So we have some broccolini and zucchini we're growing in some landscape fabric. And we have our garlic overlooking the city. That's downtown St. Paul on the right. So we're really close to there. Some more on-farm photos. You know, a lot of cut greens, a lot of radishes. But yeah, just to get a sense of our scale and what it's like on the day-to-day, and maybe you can imagine what equipment makes sense in this setting, and maybe what equipment doesn't make sense in this setting too. So Natalie shared a lot of information with you all. She's shared a lot of information with us. It's not always good news, you know, when you're talking with Natalie, but it always gets you closer to where you want to be. So what did we learn? Well, the charts spoke for themselves. A lot of things were off the charts, right? And we were included in those charts. So a lot of things were high. Our calcium was high. Our potassium was high. Our phosphorus was very, very high. Our pH was high. And for a while, our salts were high, too. We had a pretty unique situation because we expanded by, and I'm going to kind of focus in on a half-acre section of land that we expanded into a few years ago. And it's unique for a few reasons. It was not being grown on for many years, probably a decade or so. I mean, it had never been farmed before. It's got a 100-year history in the city of St. Paul. It used to be a street sweeping dump, and then it underwent a brownfield remediation process, which basically means, you know, they took some soil away, they put a clay cap over that old toxic soil, and then they brought in new soil to kind of to replace what they took away. So really unique site. Can anyone else raise their hand if they are working with that situation? I'd be curious to see. Okay, we got a couple. So so what we did is we said yes to a lot of compost when we started growing there. We thought more nutrients, the better compost. It was free to us, which is, you know, when someone offers you free nutrients, we just said yes, the more the better. So this is a cautionary tale. And I think in the past we had been doing what Natalie mentioned of kind of putting on kind of a consistent amount of compost, maybe an inch, you know, on our beds each year. And compost was really our main, you know, it was like our bread and butter. It's what we looked to solve all of our problems nutrient-wise. And we thought it was working for a long time. And I think adding a ton of compost to this space opened our eyes to some of the things that could be detrimental about that. So we were putting on a lot of things we didn't need more of, you know, phosphorus, potassium, things like that, while not really addressing our more pressing lack of nitrogen. And that's just something we kind of have looked straight at in the last couple years. And now we understand that a practice of overapplying those nutrients that we had too much of probably already has and will likely affect waterways nearby, which is something we don't want to do. And too much compost also resulted for us in raised salt levels and raised pH levels. We were working with food waste-based compost and a lot of like table scraps. So I think that had added salt content for us. But what we learned is kind of, we don't always know what we're gonna get with compost. All compost is different. We could test it every time, but what we do know is that we're gonna get a lot of things we don't need. So what are we going to do differently going forward? we don't want to add nutrients that we don't need, which sounds so simple, but we've been doing that for a really long time. It's how we apply nutrients. We apply all of them at the same time. So we're really going to kind of zero in on using nutrients that we really need. And for a long time, I think Natalie mentioned like there's 10 years worth of phosphorus in a lot of the soils that you tested. I think, you know, we're just going to need nitrogen for quite a while. So it also means doing more regular soil testing and zeroing in on applying specific nutrients. So nitrogen is what we need. For us, what that's meant is using blood meal. We'll see if we have time to talk about what that application process actually looks like. But for us, it's been really, really easy to tie into the way that we flip beds, that we prep beds. It's not so different than when we were applying compost and relying on that. And we will also likely use more cover crops going forward. We are farming in the middle of St. Paul. We have an acre and a half total. And so I think a lot of people can probably relate that it's hard to take land out of production, especially for a whole season or even half a season. It's a really big sacrifice to make. So we're playing around with that with some fall successions of some different nitrogen-rich cover crops, but that'll be something we're exploring as we go forward. Some more Urban Roots friends here making an appearance. But, you know, we do also just have phosphorus that we're dealing with in the soil. We're also, the site that I'm talking about is on a hill. So talk about, you know, nutrients being able to move through the soil and away from our site. We've been kind of planting, as you can see, a lot of native perennials around the hillside just to try and catch that and create a buffer, which is paired really well with a lot of our conservation programming that we have going on. Another thing over the last few years that I wanted to touch on, and let's see how much time I have. Okay, got a little time to talk about this. So we had a lot of nutrient difficulties on that hilltop that I've been talking about. And over the last few years, we tried a lot of things to address that. And I think we did. You know, we got our nitrogen up to a point where we had what we needed. Obviously, our other nutrients we had plenty of. And we were still struggling to get the results with our vegetables that we wanted. So Rivoli Bluff is the site with the hilltop that I talked about. I kind of already gave you the context around, you know, what makes that a really interesting site. But what I wanted to say is that about 6 to 8 inches down, we realized we're hitting a hard pan of soil. So although we had the nutrients we needed, we still weren't getting the results we needed, and we had to figure out what other variables are at play here. And for us, that looked like compaction. So that's really what we're zeroing into right now. You know, there was a lot of heavy machinery used in the brownfield remediation process, and we think that could have caused a lot of compaction lower down in the soil. And basically, you know, when there's that compaction, it's just limiting the plant's ability to do what we want it to do to reach the nutrients that may or may not be there or just reach their full maturity. And so Natalie helped us. This is kind of a chart that Natalie helped us put together. But, you know, the red, even the orange readings there are just showing that the soil is truly too compacted for roots to actually penetrate that, the vegetables that we're growing. So it's not the same everywhere, but we know that that area, you know, the plants can only do so well in that space. So we've been thinking about how do we address that. We're kind of shying away from using heavy machinery. I think we kind of assume that's how we got there, and we want to explore some other opportunities. And so we want to kind of try using cover crops to see what we can do there. We want to put some space aside so that we can basically use cover crops to passively, over the course of a season, give our soil a chance to rest, and also just let different crops do their thing and let their roots really, really kind of dive deep throughout the year. So we've been experimenting with that a little bit. Last year was our first year, and I talked with a couple people at U of M Extension, and I think the Grossman Lab as well was helpful in helping us figure out that Japanese millet would be a great option for us. You know, it's got fine roots, which arguably is actually better at breaking up that really compacted soil. It is drought tolerant, which was a really big reason that we chose it. Our water access is spotty. It's not exactly where we want it to be. And if we knew that this, we could have a quarter acre that we didn't have to think about how to water it during our droughty summers, we were excited about that. It can be grown all season long, which we felt like gave it a great, you know, probability of actually being able to do what we want it to do and send its roots down. And it was very easy to manage. We could sow it above the ground. We didn't have to plant it under the soil. We weeded one time with a volunteer group, and otherwise the millet outcompeted most weeds. Here's what it looked like when it was growing. Kind of a stand of it. That's what it looked like with the seed heads. We didn't want the seeds to drop because we didn't want millet there the next year, this coming season. So when we saw this happening, that's when we knew it was time to mow. So we'd mow it to be about 4 inches tall, and we mowed maybe three times throughout the year. So it really was not, it didn't take a lot of thought to take care of this. So our initial results show that, yep, the cover cropping did actually loosen the soil. We did a spring reading and then a fall reading. And next year, we want to kind of dig into this a little bit more and compare three cover crops. So we want to compare Japanese millet, daikon radish, and winter rye. And the winter rye we already planted, and we'll see what that overwintering does to give it kind of a head start. We'll also do more research about the specific nature of brownfield remediation. Is it the clay cap we're bumping into that's giving soil compaction? You know, how standard are brownfield remediation processes? Are they all the same, or are there lots of different ways to do it? And do we not want to break up that clay cap? Maybe that clay cap is there for a really good reason, if that is the clay cap. And so, you know, maybe we just need to build up the soil, not with compost, but with maybe just topsoil. And we want to just make that information shareable with other folks because cover crops are affordable and there's lots of ways to get them for free through research. And you don't necessarily need a ton of equipment to break up soil that way. So that's kind of what we're going into, and that's my presentation. So I think there's about a minute for questions for now, and then we'll see how much time there is at the end too. Yeah. Yeah, so with the millet, we did end up having to till it in the fall just because those seed heads were producing so quickly. Like as the fall went on, sometimes it was like you could mow it and you'd have a month before the seed heads came back. And later in the season, you had 2 weeks before the seed heads came back. And then it was like every 3 days those seed heads came back. So we had to mow and till it in for that reason to terminate it. And so, yeah, we're hoping there aren't a bunch of millet seeds. I think we got it. And this year, that same space will actually be where we measure those other crops too. I think millet would have been a winter kill, so if it weren't for the seed heads, I think we could have just let it terminate that way too. Yeah. Uh huh. Yeah, we haven't had any pushback from the community. It's actually where one of our community garden sites is, and there's like, you know, a lot of community input on that site. And we're still really great partners with the folks who originally developed housing right next door and oversaw that brownfield remediation site. So there is more information we're able to access that way soon. It hasn't quite come to be that time quite yet. But yeah, we think that those records are probably accessible. And they did jump through a lot of hoops to make sure it was very safe to grow food. And on all of our soil tests, we're always checking for like the big red flags for what might come up in those situations too. Yeah, maybe one more question.
I'm also in the metro, so I'm curious, are you finding a local source for blood meal, or I don't know, associated that one coming from cake bone production? Mm-hmm.
We haven't found that yet. Last year was our first year of really looking into the blood meal and using that in the way that we're using it going forward. And I think we got it somewhere from the East Coast, actually. But as I was walking around the booths, I was actually trying to take a look and seeing if there were any blood meal distributors. So does anyone know of a good distributor around here? Maybe somebody in the room's got to start that up or something. And I will say, too, that I just forgot to mention earlier, but we are trying to, I mean, we're doing spring and fall soil tests. So as, you know, a big thing in these next couple years is as we're looking at blood meal as our main source of nitrogen, just making sure we're really zeroing in on, like, how much are we applying per bed foot and making sure we're not over-applying that. And that's part of that spring and fall soil test is how much was in here in the spring. You know, we farmed a season and how much is left over. And it looks like this first year we did a good job of using all that up and not having much left over, but not nothing too. So it was, I think, beginner's luck this year, but we'll try and do it again. Okay, I think I'll pass it off.
Hello, everyone. I'm Lauren Berry from Dancing Gnome Farm. I run a roughly 5-acre certified organic vegetable operation in Wabasha, Minnesota, southeastern Minnesota, with my partner Michael and our 1-year-old Arthur and Holly the farm dog, and a really awesome crew of staff that really help keep everything running. Wrong way. We are pretty much fully direct-to-consumer farm, so we go to a farmer's market up in the Twin Cities, and then we also have a roughly 75-member CSA up in the Twin Cities and locally in Wabasha. I come to farming with a background in ecology, so I studied ecology as an undergraduate and had the opportunity to work on various studies that were looking at climate change impacts on plant communities around the world. So I spent a couple summers in Oregon, a summer in Tibet, and another year as a Fulbright scholar in Hangzhou, China. When I was ready to come back stateside, I started interning on farms. So I worked a year at Foxtail Farm in Osceola, Wisconsin, and another year at Loon Organics out in Hutchinson, Minnesota. In 2014, I moved to Stockholm, Wisconsin, and started working at A to Z Produce and Bakery, and at the same time started my own little farming operation on 1 acre as kind of an incubator with an 11-member CSA and our beautiful pack shed. So we all start somewhere. I met my partner, Michael, who is running a kayak guiding business down in Wabasha, Minnesota. And in 2019, we moved the farm to Wabasha, Minnesota, to Bluff Valley Farm. So David and Catherine Schmidt, you might run into them, they're here. They are a wonderful couple who bought this farm in 2016 and have been cleaning it up and sort of working to move it towards a regenerative agriculture vision, excuse me, since then. So they did a lot of cleanup to start with and then started putting in infrastructure and doing other improvements, planting perennials, and all sorts of things. One of the really neat things that they did when they first bought the property was to keyline the property. So you can see we're in the Driftless region, which many of you know, but there's a lot more topography. We're sort of in this bowl, so sort of surrounded by these bluffs, and water flow and erosion and runoff is always a main concern. So they keylined the property. They bought a used bulldozer and came in and put in berms and swales along the contours of the property with the idea of helping to slow the water down those slopes. So like many of you probably, has anyone started farming in one place and moved to another place and had to have the experience of it's exciting and also humbling to have your growing systems and then move to a new place and sort of have to realize, okay, some of the things that were working before don't necessarily work the same way, and so we're sort of constantly learning and continuing to adapt our practices in this new place. But we really love it here. It's really beautiful, and we're happy to be here. So one thing I think about when I'm in a place like this at conferences or reading books, we're constantly taking in all of this new data, and the challenge is how do we filter that out and make sense of it and take steps forward for what we want to actually implement on our operation. So I think of it as two different steps in my brain so I don't get overwhelmed. So first, I'm taking in that information, figuring out how can I use that to assess my current operation, and then what am I going to do to implement changes going forward. So what new questions, sort of from like that research perspective, what new questions am I going to be asking after learning the things that I've learned? And then what data are we collecting? And that can be like soil tests, like hard data, but it can also be the things like when I go into my high tunnel and I'm assessing how things are doing, what are the new metrics that I'm looking for? So maybe it's a component of like soil texture that I might be noticing, or something about plant performance that's a new thing. Then deciding what we're going to implement. And we all sort of make decisions by running them through a decision-making framework. So we might have holistic goals. If you've gone through Farm Beginnings, we're really familiar with that. You might have a climate change resiliency plan. Little plug for that. It's a really great thing to sort of distill all of the challenges that we might be facing with climate change and sort of have a framework to make steps going forward. And so we're all taking that information, figuring out how to go forward with it. So with that, what did we learn from this study? So here's lovely Natalie and our amazing employee, Espoir. You might also see her at this conference doing the study this spring, doing the soil infiltration test, you can see. So the first new question that we're asking is, how can we meet more of our nitrogen needs without just resorting to compost all of the time? And sometimes new data helps us reinforce things that we're already doing, which I think is also valuable. New data doesn't necessarily mean you have to do new things. It can reinforce the things you're already doing. In this case, we saw that nitrates in our soils were moving down in the soil profile, so we were losing them. And things like rye, cover crops like rye, can really help scavenge that nitrogen and keep it in the top of the soil surface. We like rye because we can plant it really late. Some of our fields we can't flip in time to plant summer cover crops, but we can usually get a stand of rye, and we just have to be really cognizant of what we want to plant there the next spring and make sure that we can get it incorporated in time. Similarly, sort of adding on to that question, we'll also continue using more leguminous cover crops to meet our nitrogen needs. One of the really cool things that Natalie had recommended that's a really cool resource is there's a video about sampling your cover crop biomass. So I think we're gonna try that this year. You like basically cut like a little quadrant of it and dry it down, and you can calculate out how much nitrogen your particular stand of cover crop is actually adding to your soil. So that seems really exciting. So we're gonna test that this year to be able to sort of really zero in on how many inputs we actually need to be adding when we're accounting for what we've already added with our cover crops. Sometimes new data just gives us a heightened awareness of things. So in this case, just thinking more specifically about how phosphorus is moving on the property. Because we have our slopes and because we're in the Mississippi watershed, we're really close to the Mississippi, just like phosphorus is a big deal and we don't want to be contributing too much to phosphorus runoff. So just continuing to prioritize keeping the soil covered and making sure that our buffer strips and our roadways are robust and can really continue to help slow down that flow of water. Sometimes there are things that are low-hanging fruit. So you hear something and you're like, okay, this is a really relatively easy change that we can make to make a bigger impact. In our case, you can see up on the left, we had really high phosphorus concentrations in sort of this low-lying area of the farm, which happened to be where we were running our chickens last year, which was really convenient, but we don't really want to be applying fresh manure to that area in wet years, which hasn't been for a little while, but it can become a seasonal waterway, so we don't want to be putting even more phosphorus in that place that's already at risk for runoff. Sometimes we can address discrete issues. So like all of the tunnels, we had really high pH in our tunnels, and our irrigation water is also high. So we are planning to trial lowering our irrigation water using citric acid. We're relatively early in the lifespan of our tunnels, so we haven't hit huge declines in productivity, but we're trying to like get ahead of that and hopefully mitigate that going forward. So that's something we're hoping to try this year and then hopefully test along the way to make sure we know how it's actually going. Sometimes there's something that should have seemed obvious, but it wasn't until Natalie said it that I realized that that's why our soil in the tunnels is getting so dry, is because of that dried out compost becoming hydrophobic. That was definitely something that we saw. So we're planning to participate in some of the cover crop trials and then just be a little more cognizant of not just putting compost down if it's like not something that we're gonna be able to like put a crop in and irrigate right away, and just sort of being a lot more aware to help us maintain that even soil moisture. We definitely have had issues keeping that even soil moisture in our tunnels. And then sometimes there are things that are harder to just like make a switch in 1 year, but they might be longer term goals that we can take incremental steps towards. And so for us, that's just continuing to reduce tillage. We've taken some steps in this regard, but there's a lot of growing room there. So joining the group that Natalie mentioned and just continuing to prioritize that as we're thinking about our longer term 3-5 year plan on the farm, taking steps towards reducing our tillage. So with that, yeah, we just are really grateful. We're always excited to be part of studies and get information from our wonderful extension educators. And we're excited to try some new things this year with our awesome crew and wonderful community. Thanks.
So the question was just about like the home soil tests you get at Menards. I think they can be, but you're probably paying $10 or $15 and maybe it's only testing pH and it's like, it's $19 to send it to the lab. So why not just do it? That's my take on it. Yeah. Are there any questions for Lauren specifically? We can do general questions for anybody. We have like 5 minutes or so.
I'm just wondering if watering within the high tunnel with a wobbler overhead system is something that you can notice, assuming you can change in the hydrophobicness.
I'm afraid to pass them on or take one if you want. Yeah, so I'm just going to like pass these around. Don't feel like you have to take one, but if you're interested in the cover crop trial, some information. So, yeah, there's a question about using like overhead or wobblers in a tunnel instead of drip. And I think that could be really helpful, not all the time. Like, there are good reasons to use drip in a high tunnel. One of the main reasons for growing in a high tunnel is disease management and having better humidity management. But in those kind of in-between seasons, you could definitely think about doing a little bit of overhead irrigation just to keep the soil moist, and especially if you've got a cover crop in the high tunnel, you could do some overhead irrigation with that. Okay, we'll see if I'm just randomly throwing these around. They're a lot filtering back, too. Okay, yeah, maybe raise your hand if you want one of these. Now I don't know who's raising their hand because of question slip. Okay. Did you also have a question?
I also have a question.
Okay. There are more circling around. Yeah, so the question was about testing compost. Unfortunately, it's a little harder to test compost. There are labs that do it, so like the University of Minnesota Soil Lab will test compost. It's more expensive than a soil test, but they will do it. Often the results just come back to you as a spreadsheet because it's something that would be more done for research than for growers. We just, on our website, published a guide to interpreting your compost report. So it's a little bit harder, but it can be done. It's also worth asking. So some municipalities are already testing their compost, or if you're buying manure, the supplier will test their manure, but if you're not asking for it, they don't always give it to you automatically. So I would say it's always worth asking before you go and do it yourself. So you can test your compost in a lab. It's just going to be a little more expensive. It might be more like $100 versus $20.
So
Yeah, so if you're in Minnesota, you would go to, like, the Research Analytical Laboratory. So I can show you how to do it. Yeah. If you're elsewhere, I'm not sure.
I'm in Wisconsin. I'm actually here.
Okay. Great. Well, we can talk after. Any other questions? Yeah.
I just remembered a couple things I wanted to mention that I didn't. And one is that Natalie mentioned, you know, to flush salts in a hoop house setting, it's good to take the cover off. And I think we're going to do that this year, but we've used the same plastic on our hoop house for like 5 years. I think we're really pushing it. And we like that. But we don't have a big tractor, but we have friends who do. And we just, when it's really snowy, we try and push as much snow into the hoop house as we can. And maybe everyone's doing that here, but that's been what we've done in the last few years. And it's takes somebody an hour who has the right machine. So that's let us still flush the soil. And as it melts, it just does that without us having to take all the plastic off. And then I also just want to say Natalie was really helpful in helping to understand that we don't, like, when I pictured cover cropping in the past, I pictured a huge field, kind of like the one that I showed pictures of. But also what we're doing is just, as we get into the late summer and we realize we kind of have what we need for the season to show up to market and have the orders filled that we've promised and planned for, and we realize we have more beds than we need, just like one bed at a time, you know, just planting nitrogen-rich cover crops. And that, I don't know why that was so amazing for me to think about, or I hadn't thought more about it, but it doesn't need to be like every bed in this huge swath. You can just do a little area, and that's better than nothing. And so that's another thing I wanted to mention.
That actually reminds me, the other thing that makes me nervous about this idea that we should all be flushing our tunnels to leach the salts out is that, like, nitrate is a soluble salt. And nitrate seems to be the main thing that's contributing. And so by flushing out salts, we're also flushing out nitrates. So that's just, like, you have to get the salts out to grow things well, right? But it's something to be aware of that you're also potentially leaching nitrate into water. And so be mindful as you're adding new inputs after you do that. Yeah.
Have you ever seen or have you ever made, like, living pathways in your inside of house?
Have either of you ever done that?
I haven't in a hoop house. No. We've always done drip in a hoop house, and so that might be a reason we haven't been watering the aisles in that way. But I've never done a wobbler, so maybe with that wobbler system that they mentioned that's more a little more overhead, maybe that would work really well. That would be cool. Oh, yeah. So we figured out, I wish I had a number for you all, but we figured out, like, what, we had an understanding of how much nitrogen per acre we needed, and that was suggested to us based on the soil samples we got through the U of M. And so we looked at, with the blood meal, how many pounds per acre we would have to apply to get the amount that was recommended per acre. And so then we broke it down into, I think, a per foot, amount for us, just like a volume. And then we thought about, I think we had an amount per 30-foot, long, 3-foot-wide bed, how much blood meal we should be applying. And I think we literally used, like, a red Solo cup that we had sitting around for most of the year. And we figured out to what point, we made a little line in there, and we would get a scoop of blood meal, and we'd kind of sprinkle it. And one thing that we needed to do is kind of keep it away from, if we were transplanting, we didn't want the blood meal to come into direct contact with the plants that we were planting. And even I think the seeds can be affected by being too in touch with blood meal. So we would usually trench, like if we were planting two rows of something, like, chard. I'd plant like two rows of chard. Then we would trench right down the middle of the bed, maybe like, three inches deep or 2 inches deep, and we would kind of put the blood meal in that way, and then we would cover the trench, and then we'd know our two rows are going to be alongside that. And it was important for us to kind of get it underneath the soil line because it is a really, we weren't getting it wet before. I know Natalie mentioned a lot of people do that, but we were just kind of trying to get it beneath the soil line and cover it and hope that it would sort of, you know, get taken up by the plants as it rained or as moisture was applied to that bed. And so if we had a bed where we were planting three rows of something, it would look like two trenches between those rows. So that's kind of how that looked. Like, yeah, so like finding a per square foot application rate and then finding maybe like a unit of measurement on your farm that makes sense to use as a good yardstick for that. Mm-hmm. We haven't done a ton in the hoop house. I think we've done rye a couple times, but not for any specific goal. I think we just thought cover crops are good, and it would be good to try it. And in the past few years, we haven't really put a lot of energy into that. But I know there's a lot of people who are trying to soon. Yeah. Do you mean in the wintertime particularly? Yeah. I think we would be really open to doing it. I think water is a really big thing for us. Our water turns off on October 15th. And so, I don't know. Is your water situation different? Or?
It doesn't turn off on us, but we have to turn it off so it doesn't freeze. Yeah, we have not yet done overwinter cover crops, but we're hoping to this year. Julie, can I offer you? Julie's done a lot of research on high tunnel cover crops. If anyone wants to check in with Julie at some point. Do you want to say something?
If anybody's interested in participating in this, it would be great to have all levels of farmers. If you have a hoop house and you're wanting to try it, we're trying to get a wide variety of growers to be involved. And basically, somebody would come out to your farm, probably be really motivated, enthusiastic graduate student, and take samples of both your soil and your cover crop to learn more about what it's doing and whether it works for you in your location. So, yeah, thanks for anybody that would be interested in participating. Please do that. Please get your information.
If you didn't get a handout, this is the same QR code. Does anyone like need a handout who doesn't have a smartphone? Okay. Any other questions? Yeah.
I have some follow-up research questions that they've asked Julie.
About this specific project?
Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe ask Julie, or we can talk after.
Julie, I'm coming for
okay.
you.
Okay. Thanks, everybody.
Run, Julie.